Oops. Uh-oh.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Ed.
I'm guessing you can hear me.
I can.
Good. Good. It took me forever to get on last week, and I figured I ought to try it a little earlier this time, and it went whoops, right through. So,
yeah.
Best shows to show you.
No accounting for internet speed.
No, it
yesterday
is.
It took me over 20 minutes to get into a WebEx meeting.
Oh, really? I hate it when it happens.
Yeah.
That is, okay.
Okay, there we have a little bit of internet weirdness.
Everybody in the world is on the internet these days because we're still all at home. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Hi, John.
Computer is saying.
Greetings. John. Hello, everyone.
Good evening, or good Hello. Morning, or good afternoon, wherever you may be.
I can mute myself so that you can.
Is Lisa here? Lisa?
She was having a little bit of a connection problem. I think she popped off to pop back on.
Okay. I was curious about the weather in California now.
Wow.
If it's calmed down at all.
Well,
hi, Lisa. Are you back?
I'm back.
How's the weather?
It's much better. Our air quality has improved considerably.
Good, good.
Yeah. I can't speak for Oregon and Washington, though. I don't know what's going on up there. But hello, everybody. Hello, Marco. Steve, I think, is joining us by audio. He wrote to me and said he's driving. Hi, Mika.
Hello.
I know there are going to be a few people who can't join us this morning. They wrote to me and said, sorry, but I'll watch the replay. All right. Jeffrey and Kate, hi. So today, I'm going to do things a little differently because I have a bit of a conflict. At 11 o'clock my time, I have to be on a Zoom with a client of mine. It's one of those meetings that, you know, was scheduled 3 weeks ago and she's really busy and changing it would just mess up everything. So, I'm going to jump off and let you guys keep talking things out and then I'll jump back on. The meeting's only supposed to be a half an hour. So if anybody's still here, I'll join back into the conversation then. So what I'm going to do this time is do a little more talking up front, and then, you know, letting you guys go off and discuss things. And then I'll come back in and see where things are at. So with that, let me just get started. So last time we talked about boundaries in a general sort of way. And today I'm going to focus more on ego boundaries. And the reason for doing this is to highlight the difference between like standing inside of a kind of unity versus standing outside of that unity and talking about it. Because where I'm ultimately trying to go is to stand within that unity and talk from it. But right now, kind of where we're at in the world, and I would say linguistically, as we stand outside of unities and talk about them. So in chapter 5, that's what I was starting to get at is, you know, being within that feeling of oneness, you know, like, where does that happen to you? How does that happen for you? It's, you know, it's happened for me in a number of different ways, from, you know, lying on a forest floor and just sort of feeling one with everything to being part of a team. You saw the picture of me in the sailboat back in my early days when I still had brown hair. and there was really something amazing about that team experience, because it wasn't just about, you know, feeling one with the spinnaker, which is what I talk about, which is that big sail out in front of the boat. It was my job to trim that. And, you know, you learn by going through kind of a mental checklist. You know, are the clues even? You know, if one clue is too high, then you have to adjust something. Is the luff curling in just a little bit, but not too much, which would collapse the sail? How's the tension on the line? And when you're first learning how to do it, you know, your brain is just like on overdrive going through all of those things. But eventually you get to this place where you just sort of, you feel it. You're just one with the sail and you just kind of can feel what it needs without having to go through that mental checklist. You know, and that's time in the boat. That's, you know, what Malcolm Gladwell calls you know, putting in your 10,000 hours. So the other part of being a team, though, was the other people. And with certain, you know, it didn't happen with every single sailing racing team that I was on, but with some of them, we just were in like such connectedness that I could be looking up at the, I also trimmed the mainsail when we were going upwind. So I could be looking up at the mainsail and thinking, oh, the Cunningham needs to be pulled. And the Cunningham is, you know, in the front end of the boat and somebody else takes care of that. And, you know, like I just think it, and then my teammate is there reaching for the Cunningham. And, you know, it astounded me whenever that happened, that we were just in such a state of connectedness that after a certain point, we didn't even have to say, hey, could you pull the Cunningham, please? You might have experienced something like this with a child when, you know, a newborn, that sort of period of oneness where, you know, the mother and child are just sort of in harmony. You could have experienced it with drugs like LSD or mushrooms. I don't have any personal experience with that, but I've heard a lot of stories. I've read a lot of stories. And the Stealing Fire, this book goes into a little more. I gave you one chapter, but he also has other chapters, you know, like about how Silicon Valley folks are microdosing LSD and things like that, just to, you know, stay on that competitive edge. But the chapter that I did give you about the Navy SEALs is another great example of where they're trained to enable their ego boundaries to drop and to function not as however many six or seven individual human beings, but as a single unit. I'm not a big basketball fan, but when you live in Chicago, when the Bulls were winning, you heard that sort of thing too, that the coach of the Bulls would get them into that sort of flow state. He was a big Buddhist. Now, it's not an always on sort of state, you know, like these guys talk about how, you know, you flip a, there was a switch that got flipped from when they went from functioning as individual egos to functioning as a unit. That, you know, our consciousness is not always, we're not always able to stay in that sort of state. Maybe there are some mystics who could, but I don't know of any. And despite the really great description of the SEAL team and how, you know, they were sort of leaderless, like whoever sort of knew the next thing to do became the leader without anybody ever saying that. It just sort of happened. They're still talking about it from outside, presumably because the author of the book, you know, wasn't part of that team, and that's really only the only recourse he has. Maybe the SEAL team can talk about it from within that state. I don't know. But he does do a good job of painting a picture of what it's like to be in that kind of unity with other human beings. And he does describe how it's not easy and it's not automatic. I mean, the SEAL teams they go through just tremendous training to break down those ego boundaries, physical and mental. So later in chapter 5, I ask the question, what fear must you conquer to make that shift? I don't really have an answer to that. I imagine it's a different fear for different people. When I was in Colombia a few years ago, we participated in these ceremonies with the Kogi tribe, which is one of the few tribes that was not conquered by the Spanish when they came. They retreated up to the mountains and basically were able to live 500 years pretty much undisturbed until climate change started happening. And one of the ceremonies that they led us through was called the Pagamento ceremony, and Pagamento is payment. And basically it's, you know, we take from the earth and take and take and take, but we never pay her back. And this ceremony was just such a beautiful way of paying back Mother Earth, because what you did was you asked, what is standing in the way of me being at one with the earth? And it could be, you know, for me, one of the things was impatience. It could be, you know, greed. It could be whatever. It's different for each person. And it's a private ceremony. You don't have to, you know, proclaim any of this. But you put that impatience into a little piece of cotton, and then you give that cotton to the earth as payment. So basically you're paying the earth by giving up the things that keep you separate from the earth. And since it's basically just energy, you know, the earth doesn't look at positives and negatives, it's all just energy, that she then turns back into, you know, life, the life-giving force. So that was the way they ongoingly, you know, like this was a daily practice, kept a kind of oneness with the earth going. So that was a tangent to what fear must you conquer to make that shift. It might not be a fear, it might be some other obstacle, some other, you know, psychic phenomenon. And I don't just mean with the earth, I mean, you know, with your other human beings, with your dog, with your cat, with the animals in your yard, whatever. So it would be good to get into that. I'm not going to open up discussion for that right now. We can come back to it because we could spend the rest of the day talking about that. The next question that I have then is, do you think we will ever get to a state where there is a critical mass of us who can flip that switch, who can get into that kind of connected flow state? You know, since we can't all undergo Navy SEAL training, or, you know, don't want to drop LSD, how else can we get there? You know, like as a people. Okay, let me just shift gears. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry, is that a question you're asking for us to respond to now? Or is this just an open-ended question?
Well, I would like to get your thoughts on these questions.
Oh, we can postpone it. I just didn't know if you.
Yeah. Let me just talk about one other thing, sort of, that I wanted to get to today.
Okay, please.
And then we can open it up.
Please do. I just misunderstood you. I thought you were posing the question to be answered now, but I'm definitely okay about waiting. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John. So in chapter 6, then, I asked the question, how does language embody the assumption of separateness? And in, I don't know if we actually talked about it in the last session, but I know there was some talk in the chat afterwards about, you know, the syntax of, you know, languages such as ours that are subject, verb, object, and the differences, thank you, Ed, with German, which is subject, object, verb. And we've also spoken about the role of words to distinguish and how having different words leads to assumptions of ontologically different things. excuse me. Even when they're connected. You know, so we talked about things like nature and nurture. Can't remember any of the others right off the top of my head at the moment, but let me just mute and clear my throat here. Boy, sorry about that. So English has words that, you know, separate things that actually like are interconnected, and because we have separate words, we often assume that they're separate, that they're, you know, actually we forget about their interconnectedness. Now, to dig a little deeper into the assumptions underlying language and its structure that help keep us in this space of separateness, let's look at the difference between content words and function words. So, let's see, page. So, when we think of language changing, I would assert that it's mostly the content words that have changed. You know, the change, for example, between the word page, meaning, you know, someone, a young man who attends to the royalty, to a page being something in a book rather than a leaf. You know, these used to be called leaves, but now we don't call them leaves. We call the things on the trees leaves. And so the language has evolved, but I would say that it's mostly the content words that have evolved. The function words, you know, like certain genes in the genome, have been conserved quite well. So what are the function words? They're the ones that basically form the structure of the sentence. So they're the conjunctions, the prepositions, the articles. You know, if you read something in Old English, or maybe not real Old English, but you like even Chaucer. You know, we had to memorize Chaucer in college. When that April in his sure is sota, the drought of March hath pierced to the rota, and something vain switched the core. Anyhow, you can kind of get the meaning based on the function words. That when that April in his shores sota, the drought of March hath pierced to the rota. Those words, you know, haven't changed since the 1300s, and maybe even since earlier. And those are the words that basically give us our spatio-temporal organization, okay? The prepositions give us our relation of things to each other. If something is on something, if something is under something, if something is by something, you know, and the articles, and the time too, before and after. The articles tell us whether it's a specific thing, you know, this book or that book. So they help us orient in time and space, and those things, those words as function words, have been conserved. Similarly with and, but, and or. So basically, you know, if you have a sentence, you know, something like the X is on the Y, the is on the, those are your function words. And your variables, the X and Y, are your content words. And those can be highly variable, you know? And that's where you start getting into depending on what you plug in, then you can determine, you know, whether it's true or not. The dog is on the rug, or the rug is on the dog. You know, you can substitute different things for X and Y and get different results, but it's the same relationality in the function words that you're looking at. So content words and function words are another kind of both and relationship. You know, you need both of them to make sense of things, to have coherent sentences. I used to have a dream of inventing a new preposition, you know, because I don't know when the last new preposition was added to the language. I think that would be a fun thing to find out, and I think it would be even more fun to invent a new one. So, you know, maybe someday. Put that on my bucket list. Okay, so I say all that about content and function words. Yeah, so content words, you know, we question content words a lot, okay? We question things like what makes a pigeon and not a crow. We don't, I assert, maybe there are people out there who do, we don't question the function words quite as much. I mean, yeah, in logic you question, you know, and or and set, you know, what constitutes conjunction and disjunction. But it's through them that a lot of the assumptions in language get hidden. And I say that because we don't question them very much. It's like they're just there. And so this is where we get into the business about Worf that was in the Deutscher article, the one about how does your language shape how you think? And he goes through a good kind of review of, you know, how Worf sprang onto the scene in linguistics and he made this huge splash, and then people started looking into it and it was like, no. And then Worf was out of fashion for a long, long time. But then recently they started looking into, you know, asking other types of research questions and actually, you know, doing some actual research with human subjects. And they're thinking, well, you know, yeah, there is something to it. It's, you know, there's the strong Worf and the weak Worf hypothesis, basically. And then Jakobson came along and said, well, you know, yeah, there are differences in the way, you know, languages enable you to think, but what languages really do is they tell you what you must pay attention to. And then he, you know, Deutscher gives some great examples of, you know, in many European languages, for example, you must pay attention to the gender of nouns, And in other languages, you must pay attention to the your spatial orientation in terms of whether it's objective or objective, whether you talk about space from a, you know, my perspective, left, right, front, back, or from a you know, compass point perspective, north, south, west. Another language, I'm not sure he talks about it, where the siblings in a family aren't referred to as brother or sister, but in terms of their birth order. So the first, the second, the third. And so that's how language, you know, structures what you must pay attention to versus what's sort of optional to pay attention to. So let me just read you now. There's Worf gets a lot of flack, but I want to read you his actual words, what he says about structure of language. He says that the structure of a human being's language influences the manner in which he understands reality and behaves with respect to it. So he's not actually saying what some people claim he's saying about language influences the way you think. That might be part of it, but he's saying it influences the way you understand the structure of language. That's the function words, I assert. There are some content words in too, but it's the structure that influences how you understand reality and behave with respect to it. Okay, so the structure, I would say, isn't limited to function words and syntax. I would also include in there your category structure, which tells you, you know, what can be predicated to what, you know, whether you can say a heavy book or a happy book, whether you can say a bluebird or a grumpy bird, you know, whether penguins are black and white or whether they're purple, you know, the categories that we have then that allow you to predicate these terms or not are based on your culture. So, or I would say they come out of our culture. Our culture behind the language tells us, you know, what's important to pay attention to, what words you can put together and what words you can't put together. And you start learning those rules very early. And you don't learn them directly, you learn them indirectly. And so you don't question a lot of the rules that tell you how your world is put together, because they're so deeply embedded in your language. And then, you know, sometimes when you get to graduate school and you do start questioning those rules, you know, if you don't have the right graduate advisor, they might tell you, don't question that. That's kind of what I ran up against. You know, it was like, no, language works just fine. Don't question it. Somebody was just probably trying to, I don't know, somebody was just at my door. Okay. So my question out of all of that then is, how does the structure of language influence our experience of ego boundaries or the lack thereof? So that's what I wanted to start our session with. Hang on just a sec. Okay, sorry about that. Somebody is at the wrong door. Okay, so I want to open it up to discussion. We can take up those questions, or we can take up questions you might have had. And then at about 10:55 my time, I'm going to have to jump off, go to this other Zoom meeting, and then I'll jump back on. So I've just dumped a lot on your lap to think about. And I'd like to hear what you think.
Could you repeat those questions, the last ones you just asked?
I just want to
refresh in my mind again. Thank you.
Okay. I'll repeat all the questions. So first it was where and or when have you experienced that kind of oneness where your ego boundaries drop? And then it was, what fear must you conquer to make the shift from, you know, like the way the Navy SEALs shift into functioning as a unit? You know, is there a fear that prevents us from making that shift, you know, on a more regular day-to-day basis? You know, and each person's fear might be different. Do you think we'll ever get to a state where there's a critical mass of us who can flip that switch and function as, you know, this hierarchical group of, I don't want to say egoless beings, but interconnected, more thoroughly interconnected beings? And then lastly, how does the structure of language influence our experience of ego boundaries or the lack thereof? And if any of you had questions from the reading, now would be a good time to ask them.
I don't mind being the first to respond. Thank you for that ensemble of questions, repeating that for me. That helps a lot. I'm just going to start with the first one and give you a sort of gut response. Where, when, experience oneness. I'm just remembering hearing a concert and it was a recital. It was Vladimir Horowitz, a great, very great pianist. Some say the greatest who ever lived, although I don't know who could make that claim since so many pianists have lived before recordings. But I saw him on stage, and I was with a friend, and I knew he was famous, didn't know much about him. I didn't know the music he was playing, but I had the funny feeling as I was watching him play. And as the first big chords, the big crescendo happened, it felt like a wave of heat that came from the stage. And I was about on the fifth row, and it went through every row in front of me. It went through me and it went behind me. I could feel it go all the way up to the back of the auditorium. And there were several galleries up there, and the sound and the feeling of that heat came all the way back down like this. So, and then literally kinesthetically, it was like this.
Oh my God.
And that was just the first 5 minutes. This piece went on for 45 minutes. So at the end of it, and I also had this faint, weird feeling when I watched on stage that I saw the man at the piano in his tuxedo, but the piano was not sitting still. The piano was moving. It was morphing. It almost looked like an animal, a wild animal that he was wrestling. So as a, you know, there was gigantic explosive applause. And then he walks off stage, and I get up, I stand up, and I turn to my companion and I say, "Let's go have a drink." So we went out and had champagne. But I remember asking my companion, I said, "Do you ever feel like the music is coming from inside of you?" And he looked at me and he said, "No, I've never felt that way." So I immediately felt, okay, I should not pose certain questions or make certain assumptions about my experience compared to his experience, because I definitely didn't experience, I felt the music was coming from inside of me rather than something that was happening from an outside. But it wasn't easy to make that kind of distinction in language, because what's inside, what's outside is so primary. And you better get that right, because if you don't get that right, the people around you are going to get really worried about you. So I'm just offering that as an example, not the only example, but many examples of all of a sudden the performer, the instrument he was using, the composer, the audience. I didn't have a clear sense of boundary. And it didn't mean that I was without self-awareness. Actually, it's a kind of a heightened self-awareness, but it was of multiple kinds of awarenesses that I was aware of, besides my own sort of "I'm over here, you're over there" kind of orientation, which we typically, I think, carry around with us. So that's my effort at coming up with an answer. I hope that made sense to somebody, because it's hard to talk about.
Yeah. You know, when the Chicago Symphony renovated the Symphony Hall, they put a bunch of seats back behind and above the symphony. And my friend had her season tickets back there. And when I joined her, it was like sitting inside the music. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, okay.
I don't know if
unmute.
I think any kind of fellow feeling that you have with a group breaks down those barriers. But I remember a morning years ago, riding a bus down Telegraph, 9 o'clock in the morning, I got on the bus and there was nobody there, except it was a black woman, slightly over middle age, maybe, you know, very respectable looking with a wool coat and bag sitting there. And the next thing that happened is a sort of homeless guy got on the bus and kind of pretended to go through looking for change for for fair and couldn't find it. And it was looked like kind of a con, but both of us dove for our purses and paid for his fare. And then that was just the three of us. And we started down the street with the sun shining and the only people on the bus. And it was a very companionable silence. I mean, we were just sort of happy being there and felt good. And the bus paused and we looked out the window and there was another woman on the street and she was having some kind of a hysterical fit. I mean, she was throwing her things and she was screaming and people were trying to calm her down. And the three of us were sitting there watching this. And finally, the woman said, "Well, sometimes life is just too much." And we all went, "Yep." And the bus headed on down Shattuck. And it was a kind of strange, it was a strange warmth of companionship. But 3 or 4 hours later, I got back on the bus to go the other direction. And the bus was packed. And the driver was the same driver, and he looked at me, and immediately the bond was acknowledged, that we'd all had this experience. And I have remembered that ever since because of the intensity of the warmth and companionship and fellow feeling I had, and the oddity that it was with people with which I had really nothing in common, or not very much. But knowing, you know, you probably felt that in a group occasionally when people were sympathetic in some sense and you all felt as part of a group.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great that it was in fact with people you did not even know. You know, that it can happen spontaneously, you know, there's a certain alchemy that allows for it, not just with, you know, people you know well, like on a team, but even complete strangers.
But there was something that happened there in that interaction when the other lady on the bus made a statement. Everyone was perceiving that same reality of the person having an episode. And she said, "Sometimes life is just too much." And I think something in like every individual on the bus there could resonate with that statement from the first person perspective.
It was very healing because it was like acknowledging the common pain and the common dilemma. We felt at one with that woman as well as with each other.
Mika and then Jeff.
Okay. I've had these experiences of oneness through a lot of different means. In doing art is one of the things that comes most to mind. Sometimes when I'm painting, I just become completely immersed in the process of painting to the extent that I don't feel that there's a separate self, separate from the objects that I'm using or the activity that I'm engaged in. I'm just completely engaged in this activity. And that's a kind of a solitary activity, I guess. But I think the feeling that I get out of it is quite similar to experiences I've had that are more collective, in which I feel the oneness in a more obviously collective sense. Like I've felt that oneness when doing yoga with a bunch of people. I can feel a oneness with everyone moving together, or when dancing with a partner or with a whole group of people in like a choreographed dance. I definitely can start to feel this sense of we're all moving as kind of one organism together. But I think there's a similar sense of just getting beyond the self that happens in both of those types of experiences that feels pretty much the same.
Following up from Michaela's comment, because I was going to say something fairly similar about writing. So when we write, we put ourselves into the shoes of other people. And so there is this sense of connect, even though they're your own fictional entities, you know, so it's this very solitary thing one does with oneself. And yet there's this thinking through the problem for other people and putting oneself inside their experience. And there are more writers today who are publishing, I think, than any time in earlier history. And the number of writers is growing, not diminishing. So I'm wondering if that isn't a tendency towards a greater engagement with the point of view of the other, which is moving towards this idea of can one develop a critical mass of individuals who are able to, you know, so this idea that there are more people who are looking at putting themselves in the place and experiencing that. And I even think about interactive art or installation art, where people are actually participating in the art as it's unfolding in a situation. And that also involves this sense of losing the boundary between the self and the art, but also other people in that context. So anyway, just some thoughts about that.
Yeah, you know, that brings up something interesting that I didn't talk about. So when you do get into that state of oneness or flow, whether it's individually through writing, through painting, or collectively in a group with people you know, with people you don't know, might it be a connection with, call it what you will, source, spirit, the great mystery, God, Atman, might it be the presence of that is what we're really feeling? I don't know. I'm posing that as a question. And to pull that into my other question about what, you know, what it is we fear, or what gets in the way, it might not be a fear, it might be, you know, one's greed or one's impatience. That prevents us from, you know, being in that space with source and or other people.
Yeah, for me, it's, yeah, very, I would be in the state if I turn away from external stimuli for some time, like whether it's meditation retreat or being in nature by myself. And yeah, being meditating in nature, that's the, when I start feeling that my like really being in the moment and feeling the interconnectedness. Yeah, I remember my meditation, my first meditation retreat, and how like my sensitivities became so like acute that I would sit and I would start feeling the leaf falling from a tree. And it was just like the best feeling, and how it like land.
Oh, wow.
Or then there was a cat with a bell, and I would hear it from away, and it was just such a pleasant, like this, I felt this oneness with this cat that walks by, and it was as if the cat like felt my energy, like that I acknowledge her and the cat acknowledges me. Like, and it's, so, and I'm thinking like if we all had this time for some time to have the opportunity to get turned off the external stimuli of the, you know, everything, and just meditate, come back to ourselves. Yeah, Actually, Kate reminded me of my experience driving buses in California, in Salinas, from Salinas to Monterey, because I didn't have a car for, out of my 3 years, for 2.5 years, I didn't have a car. Then I had to get a car because I couldn't live it where I lived in Salinas anymore. It was dangerous and too stressful. And it's always, I was like stressed, but and it kind of put me in this, and actually I was going through such a deep, like my fragmentation of my personality. Like it's like I thought that I was so dysfunctional. Like I couldn't do anything with the students that were, and I felt like such a failure. But at the same time, I felt like this was such a, like I forgot about my ego entirely. And that right in the bus, it was like the people gave me, I was like, they made me, some made me smile. They were, and people would tell stories. There was a guy who got shot because it's, and he was in a wheelchair and everybody was helping him. And I really felt disconnected that this is what makes us like that. That's how we should be, that everybody just like, just because we need to help, we need to, yeah, like the sharing change. And so, yeah, there was something like really, I really enjoyed that. Like I would, and I would take a bus to Watsonville just to experience like the difference. And it was such a good experience. Always like, and the drivers were also like, there was some, they loved their job. And they always, like one bus driver stopped in Pacific Grove to show this octopus at night, like the lights. So he purposely, there were a few on the bus. It was, and then like, oh, I need to get off near CVS. He said, okay, I cannot stop there, but I will drop you off here, but you have to get out quickly. I have no right. And they would always do these things like the, oh, yeah. That, oh, that's enough change. Like you can just pay that much. Like, very often it was the.
Yeah. I need to go. I'll come back and, John, can I leave this in your capable hands?
Sure, I'll just repeat the question. There's... Thank you, Lisa.
Okay. I'll see you guys on the other side.
And I have a question to ask you when you get back about your language.
Okay.
But I'm looking forward to your coming back. Is there anyone else who would like to develop some of these questions? Marco and Ed, I don't think we've heard from you, and I believe there are others on this call. So feel free to chime in whenever you want. Stephen, I think, hasn't spoken yet.
I think Stephen's listening on. He's driving right now. I don't think he's going to be doing a lot of talking.
He's on the road. He mentioned
he's on the road. So
yes.
So Ed, you don't have any thoughts? Okay. Go ahead, Kate.
I don't know if it was Ed. One of us, I think it was Ed, said that he believed that the language changes because it's a reflection of consciousness changing. That is, it changes on the area of the level of imagination and a deeper level of being. And then language catches up with that. It's not that we change language to change consciousness. Our consciousness changes and the language changes. And that's more or less the school of thought that I belong to. And the other question I had for the group, because we have different orientations, is I'm interested in Jung because of his hermetic. He created a connection with hermetic philosophy, sort of made it accessible within a 20th century context. And Hillman is different because he kind of drops the idea of individuation. He doesn't think that the project of human life is this evolution of the self into, you know, a perfected state. And that's the only thing that I really identified with in Jung and hermetic thought in general. So Hillman became extremely boring to me, because if it's not about a metamorphosis of the self and consciousness, then what else is it about? So to me, the whole idea of evolving language is all tied up with deeper levels of consciousness that are evolving and then language is beginning to express it. I didn't know how the rest of you felt about that.
You're talking about Jung and who is the other person you were talking about? Hillman. Oh, okay. Yeah, Hillman. Okay, that, yeah.
Yes. Is language first and then consciousness grows, or is consciousness growing and then language catches up to it?
Yes, so I'm responding to your previous post that we made on the forum, the written post, because there was a lively discussion about Jung and Hermetic philosophy, and I think I talked about Hillman. And we could go in that direction. That's an interesting direction to go in. But I would also like to hear something from Marco or Ed, or if Ed doesn't want to, if you guys don't want to speak, let us know that and we'll move on. Because I want to be sure everyone's voice is in this, and I'm using the metaphor of a circle. We're in a circle here, and if everyone's voice is heard or not heard, if someone wants to be silent, that's cool too, but I just want to be sure that that's happening. Okay, so Marco or Ed, do you want to share anything?
No, I'm good right now. I'm very content and listening and taking it all in, so.
Okay, Marco, do you have a response to the original question, or?
I have a few thoughts, I'm a little bit reluctant to launch into them because they're not fully congealed. And we have somebody joining us, Consciously Connected Travel. Okay, that sounds interesting. Hello there? We'll let them listen in. Maybe they arrived in the wrong destination on their conscious travels. So there's something going on deep, like in the sort of subtext of the conversation, I think. And I have a sense, I'm intuiting, I believe, where Lisa's, like where she's sort of navigating us. And it has to do with this question of unity and difference, unity and separateness. And when we, she seems to be wanting to us to kind of explore like how we can experience more unity in at the same time that we don't sacrifice important modes of differentiation, separateness that is integrated, different, which I would call differentiation. I think, insofar, hi there, by the way, Karina, you're here for consciously evolving language? Yes? Okay. Then we'll just continue on, and then during a break, maybe when Lisa comes back on, you can introduce yourself to the group. This is our second session, so everyone else here already has introduced themselves. But I'll just try to continue the thought that I was in the middle of, because I want to hold that relationship between unity and distinction or separation or differentiation, those different modes of difference, which have different value, kind of tones of value associated with them. We tend to think of separateness as bad, maybe differentiation as better, unity as good. But I would submit that there are times when we don't want to be unified, and when differentiation or separateness or individuation, any term that connotes that we're taking a stance apart from a unity is important too. I think of totalitarian type systems that we want to be distinct from. We don't want to be able to, we don't want to speak from the first person plural perspective. We want to speak from a first person perspective over and against or in opposition to a totalizing plural a totalizing collective. So I think it's very subtle. Like when we get into this play of unities and differences, because it's one thing to have a kind of mystical experience, and maybe not even like an extraordinary, just a sort of normal mystical experience with a leaf falling. But one also could, out of a sense of unity with the earth, become very oppositional towards humans, because one identifies them with, you know, being the perpetrators of despoiling the earth, rightly so, perhaps. Or I would say yes. But so I want to just bring that sort of sensitivity to, like, when we want unity and when we want difference. And perhaps there's a deeper unity there in that sensitivity that we're navigating. Because like being one with a team of Navy SEALs, for example, may be cool, but it also may be acting as like the appendage of an imperialist project. And so when we are one, how are we integrating with or respecting differences? That would be a question that I would pose like in my reflections on like the conversation that we're going in. And I think what language allows us to do, which is really, I think, extraordinary, is it allows us to move between unity, difference, integration, distinction, resolution. And so it kind of doesn't force us to be one or the other necessarily. Like I think that we can relate to language in a way that lets us manage the field that we happen to be in. And that's what's happening, like in an example like Kate shared, where a statement arises that like crystallizes a unity, crystallizes a kind of emergent unity in the field, and then has this sort of temporal like ripple effect where it carries with you. It's really wonderful. Anyway, that's just some riffs on the first part of the conversation. And I really have, I got a chance to catch up on the forum thread that we talked about Jung and a number of things, dream reports, ontological levels. There's a ton actually to get into that we can, but I just appreciate where the conversation's going, and I'll leave it to someone else to continue.
Yeah, right before this meeting, I was on the Zoom with there was a lecture on language and reality in early Hasidism. So it's interesting there. He was talking about how so everybody has to find their inner world, and I even wrote down, so the flames of one's inner world, one's inner desires, and express that. No matter what it is, but it's your inner, like coming from within, right? And then it will be transformed. This fiery intentionality will be transformed and forged anew, and will be like will be uniting kind of everyone. But this is, so for me, what I took from that is that the importance of finding our inner passion, our own voice. Yeah, that's, and like in our society, very often that, you know, we have to silence our, and I think this is very important, that this is our individuality that will bring us in unity with others. But this is inner voice that's, I think, very important, that it's not silenced by the political correctness and many other factors that we are afraid. I think that fear, like one of the fears that I thought about, is that being afraid to express my ideas and thoughts that will be oppositional to maybe majority or my perceived, that I would be perceived as something. So it's like, well, it's a lot, probably a lot has to do with ego. Like, for example, this extract that we read for the about the Navy SEALs. So I read it from a totally, so the whole time I was reading, I actually saw a lot of Igor in this piece, like the, or actually showing off this, how special we are, how, and then like we are doing it for the better, for the, like working as a community, like what community are we talking about? It's just like the, really, like you said, appendage to the imperialist force. Like, why did you have to capture this man in his own, on his own land? Like, what? So he is perceived as terrorist. And like, I'm reading everything I read as a projection of them. Like, oh, that's what you do. I wrote like these words. Isn't it what exactly? That's what you recruit. They were recruited, they were trained, and they were sent to kill. Well, in this case, they didn't kill. But then I was like, I'm reading it like, okay, capturing this important, as they said, why is it important? Why so much money is spent for that? And there's this, a lot of just egocentrism and totally someone, like it's again, the language that is used, like that Hollywood is mentioned. So definitely like there is, you know, like this hidden, that unconscious desire to actually show off. Yeah, and so for example, like I would like totally see, then I would say, oh, I'm so negative. I always see through my biases. This is my, this. But this is what I want to express, so I express that. And despite, but I will be, well, on forums when I say something like that, I get so much like, roar, and right away, Klimov, your last name, or you call me, you this, so everything is, which I already used to, but still, there are seconds of like, how do I frame that? But I should like, you know, like I'm not a good speaker and I stumble and I this, but this is my voice. This is how I am. So and everybody should feel that, to be like, here I can just say whatever I want with you, feel safe. And well, anyway, sorry for long.
Thank you, Misha. I appreciate you sharing your voice.
Does anyone remember what some of the other questions were? I'm forgetting them again.
What fear would you need to conquer in order to feel more unified in a group, and do you think that we will get to a critical threshold where there are enough people susceptible to the idea of unity that it will trip a critical threshold so that we are more unified as a human race? So it's talking about, she wants to know what kind of fear keeps you from wanting to feel unified with other people.
Thank you.
I can respond to her question. I think there is a fear sometimes. If you walk out your door and there's a riot, there's a lot of people running and screaming. And there, you can see some people are going in one direction, some people are going in a different direction. What do you do? You don't know it's a riot yet, but you get these strong visceral feelings. I've been in a couple of riots. I've been in lots of demonstrations, and I live in Manhattan, and a lot of them are happening a lot lately. So it's a weird kind of feeling when you have an intention to go shopping at the store, and then all of a sudden you get swept up in this kind of many, many voices and many, many intentions and different agendas, and you don't feel safe at all. There's a kind of excitement, but you have some choices to make. You want to move away from this, or you want to move towards it. So there's some ability to differentiate from whatever the group is doing and make some kind of choice. And I think that's important that we don't give that up and just saying, oh, I'm just egoless, whatever. You know, I think it's great to be ego-free in certain circumstances. But I think when people say that they have no ego, I think they should be avoided. I don't have much it's very hard to resonate with someone who makes those kinds of claims. So I think those fears are very real of when you want to be a part of a group and when you want to be apart from a group. And I'm sure we've all had many of those experiences. And but I also think there's sometimes a real joy in participating with a group that you may share values with, even if there are differences. I think Marco mentioned that when we are one, how can we be at one with others and respect differences? Yeah, I think that's very important. And I believe it's desirable. I think it happens often to us. We just may not pay much attention to it when it happens, but we are very, very aware of the traumas that may have occurred to us when we were left out of a group, or we were pushed out of a group, or we were punished for not responding appropriately according to other people's values. So I think we carry that all around. We carry all of that around with us. So this is just my extemporaneous kind of response to the fear question. But I don't think it's necessarily always about fear. It could be just like Marco was doing, I think taking a critical stance, taking a meta perspective. I think he was doing that primarily. Whereas I think Michaela was talking about painting and dancing and moving. And Jeffrey was talking about writing and walking in someone else's shoes. And I was talking about a concert I remembered and feeling that the flow of the vibration that was moving between me and the music and the audience. And I think Misha was talking about a cat. He was out in the woods and he saw a leaf falling and there was a cat. I think he said there was a bell, maybe the cat had a bell. And you were aware of the cat and you were also aware that the cat was aware of you.
Yeah, it was at a monastery.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think Kate mentioned a social situation where she was on a bus and something happened that was shared and there was that memory of that. The bus driver resonated with her or responded to her. And so I think these are kind of sort of ordinary experiences. But I think it's challenging for us to talk about them sometimes and to put them in words. And I think that's maybe what is a large attractor for all of us. How do we, you know, if someone poses a question like that has been posed to us, how do we respond to the words? I find that myself, I don't like at-one-ment. When people talk about being one, it makes me really nervous. It's a very totalitarian kind of language for me. Unity works better. Harmony is even better than that. But I think these are all sort of related. These kinds of words are about choice and are related and overlap in some ways. But so that we have a wide repertoire of synonyms that we could use probably. But for me, it's the flow of vibration. It's a highly valued experience. And I want more of it more often. often I find myself very constrained in a kind of I'm here, that person's over there. There's sort of a risk at allowing myself to be open to a flow that could happen, especially as I live in a very large city with a lot of strangers. But when that, when both persons are open and there is a flow, it can be extremely satisfying and memorable. Years later, you may think back of that stranger you had that shared a joke with, or a look or a glance of recognition. So I think those are what probably holds our civilization together, is the sidewalk. I think it was Jane Jacobs said, what holds the civilization together is the sidewalk. Because when people are passing each other on the sidewalk, you know, it's typical to raise your hat or make a gesture or smile. And even if it's a perfect stranger, there's a kind of a safety that the sidewalk provides for people moving around in the city. But if we're all in our cars and we're speeding through, speeding through neighborhoods and we're not having those kind of mutual eye contact, a gesture, we can, you know, experience widespread alienation. So I think we're in the midst of that right now, since most of us are wearing masks, and it's required to get into a store, you have to wear a mask. And it's influencing our communication very dramatically. So I've gone on too long perhaps, but I hope some of that makes sense to somebody. And I'm really open to however way you would like to respond to these questions, or have any questions you want to offer the group, that would be great.
I wanted to follow up with a little bit of what from what Misha was saying, because and it ties back to Lisa's writing in her book, because she talked about Avatar and about the film Avatar. And I do feel slightly hesitant, because I think Avatar, I feel it's very Hollywood and very disconnected in some ways from real life. But, you know, it has been raised as an issue. And when I went to see that film, I remember being extremely disappointed with it. And the reason was because it describes a society in which things are sort of connected and, you know, in this kind of interesting way. And yet the way to defend this way of life is through war. I mean, guerrilla war, whatever. But in my point of view, when I saw the film, I thought it was going to be about nonviolent protest. And it was, you know, I may be informed by, you know, Le Guin's writing in The Wolf for World is Forest, or this kind of thing where but to me, a society that is focused on being connected, I have a disconnect with this idea that you would take arms and then fight a war based on that. That seems to me a complete disconnect between the one reality and the other reality. And of course, the language issue comes into it, you know. So if the language is the language of the avatar, the people, doesn't seem to reflect this, but it, you know, so it's this issue about how does the language reflect the war tendency within this context. It seemed to me that, and it seems to me that the whole thing is tied up together. So if we have a language that allows us to go to war, or that we have a way of going about things, of taking things towards warlike activities, then how is that reflected in the language? And so it comes back to this issue of how does language affect that, and how does that affect language? But the whole issue of understanding and respecting each other in this context seems to me relevant in it, you know, in relation to all these questions. So I'm sorry if my intervention is a bit chaotic. It often seems to be the case. Maybe it's retirement that's just discombobulating my thinking.
I think we're used to chaotic interventions, Jeffrey. It's not unusual, but they serve the purpose of keeping things moving in the middle, because the last thing that you just said is really the thought that's on my mind. I don't think it's a matter of does language affect, or does experience affect language. I'm sure that there's an interplay between them. But, you know, at root, this comes back to what Kate said, at root, I think we start with our experience. And for some reason, either we want to share it with ourselves, because most of the talking that most of us do doesn't happen with other people. It goes on in our heads. And I'm sure a lot more words flow through there than they do out there here in the ethers between others. And so we're looking for ways. This goes back to what you had said before. When you're writing, you're trying to figure out the experience of another. You're actually feeling your way through that. And sometimes it's easy to express and sometimes it's more difficult to express. And when it is, you find yourself, and I know you do this in what you write, you start stretching the language. Marco does this when he's writing poetry. You start stretching it. You start trying to make it fit here and fit there. And I don't get the feeling that we're all that concerned about what we're doing, as if we're violating some principle. It's just like, well, if this is what I want to get across in some way, then I have to find a way to do that. And I'm not sure, the part where I stumble sometimes is it's the impression I get that language is somehow in the way. It's blocking that. And I don't think it's blocking it. I just think it is as it is. And it's not, it itself is a product of whatever it is that we do as human beings, does kind of have to catch up with where we are in our consciousness and in our experience, because that's what I think's at heart there. And so we make these attempts. I don't agree with the idea that all we do is change content words. I think that if we really stop and take a look at language, we'll find that how we use prepositions is different than how our forebears did. I think there have been shifts of meaning and nuance that probably go undetected. For those who were present for it, we read Gates's Grammatical Mirror a long time ago, and it's only a short piece. It's only about 10 pages long. What's fascinating was the most fascinating part of that article for me was he spends 4 pages talking about the new use of and. And he's doing this through a number of languages. He's doing it in French, he's doing it in German, he's doing it in English, and how it is a connective, but it's not just a connective, and it's not just a function. There's something else at work, there's something else going on there. And for me, language is much bigger than words or sentences, because we have to connect them with all of the other thoughts that we've had. If we look at this, what we're talking about now, everything we are saying is influenced by everything that has been said in this conversation up until now. And so all of those strands of connectivity reach back into the entire discourse that is what we have this evening. And so the meaning of any individual, let's say, phrase that we might, John says something, it's a very nice turn of phrase, but that came out of this entire discourse, not just out of John. So that also plays into this. So it's to me, it's a much more complex dynamic that I'm not convinced, being an analytical type, I like to take things apart and look at them, how they function. But it's sometimes helpful and sometimes it gets in the way as well. And we can very easily lose sight of the fact that it's in this overall dynamic of how our minds and our senses and our experiences are changing. Each and every moment flows back into what we then express language-wise. And some of these changes stick, and some of them get carried beyond our little circle, and some of them don't. So to me, it's nice to think about how can we feel more connected? I'm with you, Jeffrey. Maybe you're that whole cultural issue that's behind it. I think, you know, language and culture play a very intimate role with one another. If you ask someone here in Central Europe, who's a German? It's not a person that has a German passport. It's a person who speaks this language natively. Whether he has a Swiss passport, an Austrian passport, or a German passport. That's what's considered German. The language actually is kind of the defining characteristic, which is not the case everywhere. We don't do that in English, for example. That's not something that we do. We decided to slice the pie differently. But those are the kinds of, but we also have cultural values. As Misha pointed out, you and I had the same feelings reading that article. about the seals. The same one. I was just sitting there going, calm down, Ed. Take it easy. You know, we got money to spend for this, but we don't have money to help people that are out of work for the last 6 months. You know, that kind of stuff comes up. Because I keep asking myself, well, why is that so important? You know, why is this? Now, as the example of how we can all get into that zone, that's how I feel. That's how I would express it. And I've been into zones in a number of it. It can be at a concert. It can be because you're something at work, even in jobs I didn't like, where you all of a sudden you're together and it just works. And it's a beautiful experience if you allow yourself to experience it. It's like John had mentioned, well, a lot of times it just goes right by and we miss it. And that's really too bad. So if we can find ways to help us remind ourselves or to be better in tune for that, I think that would be very helpful. But, you know, this is a real, for me, this whole thing is a very, very complex and dynamic thing. And that's why I kind of enjoy seeing how others look at this and they can assert, I think it's this way. That's what I always hear when we say things. I know that's what I mean when I say it. I don't always say, I think it's this way, but that's, I can assert a lot of things, but it's just what I think for the moment. Could be in 10 minutes after Jeffrey or Kate or someone else has said something, I'm going, well, I really don't think that so much anymore. You know, that happens as well. But anyhow, it's in that dynamic part is the part that's at the moment for me, the most dynamic.
I wanted to comment on something that John said. He said he's been in a riot before and he goes out the door and he has people running this way and people running this way. And he feels the energy and he doesn't. And I would suggest that's exactly how all of us are feeling right now with the divisions in the country, you know. And my thought at the time was, I can sympathize with somebody who is pro-Trump and I can sympathize with somebody who's not. I'm at the point where I am beginning to transcend left and right and looking at kind of holding both sides into the same, in my mind at the same time, because I don't think that it is a matter of one being right and one being wrong anymore. So that's the difficulty, is how do you transcend divisiveness outside? You know, how do you transcend that? And talk about politics in ways that doesn't put you immediately into somebody's crosshairs, you know, for attack.
So I agree with what has been said about how language and culture are part of what keeps us from getting to this place of interconnectedness. A lot of languages, at least, reinforce this sort of ordinary state of mind, which involves subject and object separation-based thinking. But I also think that it is fear, partly, that keeps us from reaching this interconnected state. And I would submit that it is just fear, period, that does that. I wouldn't say it's any particular kind of fear, because I think fear really is something that's tied to the ego. Feeling that one has a separate self or an ego kind of brings fear right along with it. They're like of a piece. And then only when we get into the state of interconnectedness or oneness does fear completely go away, I would say. So just kind of a structural thing.
Yeah, I was thinking about fear of losing oneself. And from the same lecture on Haidism, right? So the one of the the I don't know how to put it, the leaders of Haidism. So he, there was this notion that if, when you speak, you, it's God speaks through you. So you have to like kind of, you forget yourself and you let the divine speak through you. So you have to be in this special state. And even he would go like someone would write what he said, and he would, when he would reread it, and something that he remembered that was conscious, he would cancel that it wasn't. It has to be eliminated. So everything remains that what God said. But this, but fear of losing oneself. How do we let it just go through us, right? Losing our ego and say the right thing for everybody. Yeah, and everything that's said, it's everybody finds value in that. Some message for them, so that what, everything that's said through that discourse that's you know, considered to be divine or, you know, inspired by the higher powers, and has a message for every single listener in this, you know, in the group, at their level. Yeah. Then I thought also, yeah, like Kate said about the, you know, the division, the Trump, so that, and the Lisa writes that when she talks about listening and speaking, like how we are, remember that, like I kind of, without distinguishing the richness of listening from speaking, or love from need and attachment, or truth from metaphor or validity, we lose our capacity to relate to the wholeness of consciousness and eliminate our capacity to access it as source. Yeah, that's, and it's like, what's behind when people speak with hatred and aggression? What's behind that? Behind that is fear that we all experience. So, but for others, yeah, it's, so we see, when we get to that, like what really behind that, when we listen, we see the pain, we see fear, we see, and we see humanity, and we start feeling compassion. Yeah, and then.
I think there's a line in the Upanishads where there is another, there is fear. And there's also a book, which I haven't read, by the title, The Gift of Fear. I read the summary of it and I got the gist of it. I mean, the idea being that fear is very important for us. It's important for us to feel fear in the appropriate context. And part of what has happened in the modern mass media politicized hyperspeed environment is that fear has been weaponized. It's kind of produced. It's mass produced, manufactured. Like we've been hacked to feel fearful all the time about everything, and that's profitable for people that sell us ways to not feel afraid anymore, whether it's buying guns or joining a party or what have you. And I think too that there is ego in fear, but ego doesn't have to only be about my individual self. There's a group ego. I can be afraid for or on behalf of or out of a feeling of connection with somebody else. If I have a friend in Oregon whose house is potentially going to burn down, I can feel afraid for them. And it's, in a way, it's egoic, but it's an expanded ego. It's a kind of collective ego. It's a social ego. So I wouldn't want to even sort of be afraid of, sort of create a sense that fear is the enemy, because fear is also an ally, but it can be used against us and we can use it against ourselves. And we tend to, it tends to kind of metastasize as an effect in our, and we become gripped by it and within it and identified with it, so that we lose that sense of perspective, that sense of unity, where there isn't the sense of an other that we were afraid of, whether it's the social other, the environmental other, the cosmic other. I do want to say, because in case I would be interpreted as being too critical earlier, that there may be an important distinction between kind of levels of unity and the kind of unity we might have with any discrete person, thing, or reality, and then the sort of ultimate unity, like the unity beyond unities, the peace that where there wouldn't even really be the question of being united with something that has an opposition to something else, because the thing that you're one with in that mystical unio mystica is by definition even inclusive of everything and nothing. So that's just a footnote. I do want to note we're at 22 or 30, we're 10 minutes past our our soft cutoff. And Lisa said she might join us, but she did have another commitment, so she may not. And we have had a new person join us, Karenna, so I want to make sure we give her a chance to say hi. You've been graciously waiting and listening. Shall we transition to maybe into bringing Karenna in? And
yes, let's do that. Karenna, please introduce yourself and what brings you to us today? Thanks.
Hello. Well, my name's Karenna, as you all know. That was me accidentally popping on a different login, so sorry about that. I've had some hiccups getting sorted for the call, so I wasn't present on the previous call, and I'm hoping to be more engaged on the strings and everything, or the threads from here on. And I kind of pop in and out of the Monterey Young Analyst Group, and that's how I found this. I tend to be kind of passive and quiet and love listening, so no offense ever there, please, but I really enjoy these discussions, and it brings a lot to my world, and I love sharing it, so I'm happy to have joined today.
Thank you. The angel of silence is passing over us.
Lots to think about.
This could go in a lot of different ways. And since Lisa hasn't rejoined us, I feel a little bit like Mama has abandoned us all. I had planned on having someone be the leader. But I'm going to deal with those feelings. And okay, so let's redirect our attention the way we want to. And that can go in a lot of different directions. And we've brought up a lot of different motifs and themes, and we have particular ways of expressing ourselves. We all have a different vibration. I have a problem with the idea of the whole and the part, and the idea that I am part of this whole. And I'm recently studying a lot of sacred geometry, which is really new to me. And the idea of the ancients had was, we think of ourselves as a part of an ecology, a part of the cosmos. Whereas the ancients thought the human isn't a part of the cosmos. The human is the cosmos. And that's a very, very subtle, but very dramatic, I think, difference. And it has a lot to do with mathematics. And the idea that there's a one and there's only a one, there's only one one, and that one is unknowable, is a part of the way ancient geometers thought. But then there was a development that happened where the idea of a zero, which was at the end came after nine, so it was a sort of like a placeholder. but there, someone had the brilliant idea of moving the, rather than 1 to 9 and then a 0, let's put the 0 in front of the 1. So that the 0 then created 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in one direction, but then the imagination sort of, well, there has to be a negative 1, 2, 3, 4. So there was a positive and negative numbers. And that created a kind of a plethora of different kinds of numbers for different kinds of purposes. And I thought that was very interesting to contrast the idea of the one as the only unknowable and the idea of a zero. And this perplexing questions that start to emerge. Well, can nothing come out of nothing? And I think those are very old kinds of philosophical dilemmas. But I think it's very, very interesting to think about, you know, how algebra and the variables that she was mentioning, Lisa was mentioning, how there are lots of different variables, and there's X, Y, and Z, and there's many unknowns when you're putting zero before the one. But if one is the only unknown, in a sense, it makes a lot of things much easier to deal with. Anyway, I'm just bringing that up. It's probably just a recent obsession of mine. But I find myself very intrigued by space and our perceptual spaces and our concepts and how we differentiate these different spaces, and how the perceptual, in my experience, is very front and center, and everything else becomes background. I can have lots of different concepts, and they're usually up here, floating around. They're back there, up here. But my percepts are, she would say, Deutscher would call it ego, or ego-oriented. It's like front, back, up, down, left, right. That's all my perceptual space. That's in my perceptual space. And I have to make those judgments. And then I can communicate effectively with somebody when I know they're up and down and they're left and right, and their spatial arrangement is similar to mine. So we can talk about an external environment that we share. But as soon as we get into concept land, we're all over the place. And I think that's a very big challenge right now. Because our concepts, although they're not arbitrary, they tend to be driven by metaphor. And metaphors are, of course, they can become dead metaphors. And we're constantly using new metaphors. And some of them stick and become part of our discourse. So that's what really interests me. So I'm hoping some of that makes sense to others. And I'm sure there's a lot of people who know a lot more about sacred geometry than I do in this group. And also, just one more thing. As an actor, we were trained very early on about spheres of attention. And there's one sphere of attention. You're imagining that you are in a sphere. Your body is in like a light. And then a sphere of attention. And then there's a stage. That's another sphere of attention. So you can go from this sphere to that sphere. And then there's everyone in the audience. That's an expanded sphere of attention. But that the actor, the performer, the musician, the dancer, he, she is always in a fluid relationship with all of these spheres of attention. So that's another way of thinking, I think, about the ego and spatial orientation and perception. And what happens when we share imaginal worlds with one another? It gets extremely tricky really quickly. So I'd love to hear how anyone else wants to articulate any of this stuff. It's pretty, we're all on a slippery slope. That's my metaphor. She used a metaphor earlier about, she said, when you flip the switch, do you think, are there enough of us to reach critical mass so that we can flip the switch? And if she were here, I would ask her about that, because that's a metaphor. Flipping the switch has may respond very differently. To me, flipping the switch is, it's a very electrical current that's on or off. It also reminds me of like when they used to electrocute people, they would say, flip the switch, you know? So I would use a different metaphor for what happens when we reach critical mass and more of us are able to enter these unified states together. And just pay attention perhaps to the fact that we enter into these unified states together, and it's very ordinary, like listening to music or dancing or doing playing with a rocking a baby to sleep. You know, these are very ordinary experiences, cooking dinner with your friends or whatever. So thank you for this opportunity to riff and to go leaderless right now.
You bring up the paradox of zero and one. In sacred geometry, the Greeks had the image of the squaring of the circle, which was their way of talking about this paradox. And the square, of course, is time. And the circle, in this sense, would be complete unity. And we're always in that paradox if we're in time. So there is no reconciliation of one to the other within our imaginations, because we don't live in a dimension that can do that. So it's, we can acknowledge it, but the squaring of the circle is the Greek shorthand for this particular kind of duality.
Is there anything else about that, squaring that circle, that you want to share? Because I'm very curious about this.
Well, there's
about
something
sacred geometry.
There's something called the salt point, which is a square with a circle and a dot in the middle. And the circle, of course, can be all eternity and everythingness, but it's also Cronus, the god of time, and the calendar turning and the clock going. And it's accompanied, Cronus is accompanied by Ananke, which is necessity. So you're in time in these patterns and you have to navigate. And the square represents the orientation. In some of the fables, it's Aeon, the Greek god of time. But you can use the cross by extrapolation. It's the square. It's vertical for eternity, horizontal from time. When you're stuck in eternity and time, ultimately you hang at that apex. You have to give Caesar what's due Caesar, and new negotiations of how you arrange that is the story of culture. How do you arrange the necessities of time to the necessities of eternity? We make new deals and new paradigms are born. I think we're in a new genesis, but we're in the salt point, which is the biblical flood. That's when, once all of this, these structures dissolve and you have to construct a new one, there has to be a new negotiation of your ethical compass. The salt being the point that is the magnetic attractor behind both mind and matter. It's the soul or the self. It's constructing this thing, but there's this time of chaos and everybody has to build an ark, you know, because that's what keeps you above the waves. It's what you believe is true. And once what you believe is true melts, you're in the biblical flood. So I'm looking at our current days as the biblical flood, because left now is right, right is left, up is down. No one can agree. And we have to reconstruct the world is ultimately what is happening. And at the heart of that dilemma is the squaring of the circle. You know, it's time and eternity meet. We hang at the apex of a duality we can't reconcile, but we have to come up with the best metaphors we can to reconcile it in the most balanced way we can to go on. I don't know if anybody else looks at it this way. I'm speaking in pretty broad. So I won't keep ranting Marco.
That makes sense to me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That was worth the price of admission for me. So. Well worth it. Thank you.
Salt is a substance in alchemy that's very mysterious. It's the only thing you have left when everything burns down, and it's what you need to start life. So in alchemy, it is the soul. So the salt is an attractor. It is driving the bus, although it's doing it in a way that covers eons. And as we repeat the patterns of culture, we're looking at the dissolution. It's alchemical. You dissolve and you recoagulate. You take out all of the oppositions and you reintegrate them into a new relationship. And I think that's pretty clearly what we're doing now. Don't you?
I tend to agree. And also there are many different ways of languaging this. And I think we have about 5 minutes left for our scheduled group today. And Lisa, due to this technology, she can look at the archive to see what how this developed and respond. And I'm interested if there are any summary statements or anything you learned today through our exchanges, and what do you know now that you didn't know before this conversation? I would love to hear about that. And I think what I learned was, what did I learn today? I think that I'm very sensitive to the field, that there's a field that we're all drawing upon in our own unique ways, and how we use language has a lot to do with what we want and what we desire, and putting that into language and then opening up to the field. And I think sharing what we want, what we desire, and our what we're perceiving opens up to that shared communal space. And I think that's very much like being a performer, except we don't have a script or notes on a page playing an instrument. We're using words, which are extremely slippery. Once again, that's my metaphor, that slippery slope. But I think mind has mountains, cliffs of fall, frightful sheer, no man fathomed, hold them cheap, who ne'er hung there. I think that's Gerard Manley Hopkins, but I love that. The mind has mountains. and it's very slippery. So thanks. So any poetry anyone wants to recite, or a tune you want to hum or whatever, please.
The mountain, first image of psyche. The world is a mountain to the earliest imagination. That's why we have pyramids and ziggurats. And gods at the top and the ocean of chaos at the bottom. The vertical axis is what connects them both. And so the mountain is the apt metaphor for consciousness. It's when the mountain melts and you have to come back out of the cosmic ocean that's dissolved you, that's significant. But I like what Ed had to say about language being predicated upon a conversation or an evolving cultural artifacts and experiences, and that it's organic, and you, even our conversations harken back to a genesis and then our development, and then we work into metaphors that we can commonly use, and it evolves a sort of structure. So I hadn't looked at it quite that way, the way you did.
I agree. I liked Ed's presentation of it, but I did love your square, circle, and point, Kate. I'm in the middle of reading Omar Khayyam's scientific work, and it dovetails perfectly with that reading. So, and of course, Islam at that period was in its own cross, as we are today in ours. So.
There is a universal language of signs and myth. You can melt it down to the mountain, tree, the cross, the snake. They are at the absolute heart of mythological language, and there's no place in the earth that you cannot find it, because I've been looking. And I like the earliest structures, because the way they fracture and iterate into more and more and more different forms become quite culturally specific. But at the heart, they're just human. They're artifacts of psyche. They're hardwired.
Anyone else have something different? Are we ready to say farewell until next time? Blessings, everybody. Stay strong.
See you next time.
May the force go with you all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.